recording. So there goes. Okay, good morning everybody, here and in the Zoom. I hope everything is visible there. I don't see your hands also so in the Zoom, so if you have problems, just talk. Okay, so today we changed the gear a bit from a previous ones. Okay, last time we had a seminar. And I apologize, I just realized that I haven't put your points yet to the Zoom. I will do it hopefully today. And then there has been Nanoscience Days. Everybody has been there, I hope. And there will be these two essays written. Let's say in a Moodle, there's a deadline end of this course. But please do it in the 2 weeks, about. Otherwise, you don't remember anymore. And then it's kind of pointless thing to do anymore. Okay.
How many pages?
Ah, yes, true. It shouldn't be too long, not like a report, but 2 to 3.
Sorry.
I don't mind if it goes to 4 and 1 is too little. Or it depends on the font. If you write it in a 8-pixel font in the one page, then that's fine also. But yes, around that. And remember, you probably are all in the seminar course also, and there you had to also write the reports. So in that course, you report about the presentation, I assume, how it was presented and so on. Here is about the topic. And you are allowed to dig in the topic more if you didn't understand something or you are just interested or. And okay.
One question about this is about the references. Can we just, for example, if all the information we use in essays from the speaker during the speak is just fine to throw in the appendix references that are in the presentation?
In the presentation, yeah.
Is just fine, or should there be like the right way to quote someone's topic?
No, I think that's a good. If you take a present references from a presentation to the end. Yes, that's fine. Because they are already presented there. But and if you find something else by yourself, then you can just add it. Yes. Okay. And of course, for next teamwork, I have to apologize. I started to kind of update my topic because I need one more. And yesterday went somehow too busy that I couldn't finalize it. But I will put them on a, let's say I put them on a Moodle by Monday. So there's not much delay. And you have a new group that I can announce. They have been already divided. But topics I have to a little bit think. Still. Okay, but today's topic is a nanofabrication. So this is more towards physics. Is it physics or biology or what it is? It varies a lot, but basically it's physics and Okay, if I have a pointer, I cannot change the slide. Okay, but I can do it here. Okay, so you have been discussing about the history of nanoscience, so Feynman's decisions, reckless molecular machines, and especially Moore's law, that everything is getting smaller and smaller, especially in our industry-wise. So that's why we have these cell phones nowadays. And let's find this funny picture I put in 3000, but I know actually that's even more funny picture because nobody uses any iPod anymore. Okay, sorry. Yeah, it's a good device. Yeah, but it used to be a really, really popular at some point, but not so much anymore. Yeah. Okay, and scaling laws, which kind of prove that small is different. You get, when you get things smaller, you can get more power, or you can get more efficient, or whatever, you can get even more physics or chemistry. But how to get to this nano size? And this is exactly the topic of today. How we can fabricate these small things? It was in Feynman's vision that you make a robot which make a smaller robot which make a smaller robot and so on. That hasn't happened. But it's kind of similar ideas, but not exactly like that. Okay, so this is outline of today. So we start from a nanofabrication, a little bit clean room techniques, then lithography, growing thin films, etching, bottom-up methods at the end. And then we have an extra topic of scanning probe microscope, which is kind of related to the fabrication, but also imaging. Okay, so what is nanofabrication? Basically methods to construction structures with a minimum dimension lower than 100 nanometer. That's a nanofabrication. If it's larger than that, it's a microfabrication, which is exactly the same technique. Just a bigger structure. Many cases, not always. And this forms a basis for many, many nanomaterial research and development. An ultimate goal, control matter in atomic scale. Of course, that's a, you want to build atomically precise thing. That's a kind of ultimate goal what you have. Do I actually have a volume on a speaker? Yeah, so we can hear. So there's a two basic division, so two basic ways how to make nanostructures. Everybody, I think, has heard these terms. Top down, you take something bulky like a tree and make a square out of it. Or in this case, you make something useful in a nanoscale. Or you take a small pieces like a Lego pieces and build up. So this is a bottom up method. And this is mostly in the physics and technology, uses top down. You know, these computer processors and so on, they always are using this top down methods mostly. But then in the chemistry and biology, everything is mostly bottom up style fabrication. And I already mentioned integrated circuits. There's some circuit which I don't anymore remember what it is. And if you zoom in, you see lots of structures. So there's an electrical component, there's a memory component, okay, there are electrical components also, and especially interconnectors. And if you take a slide here, you cut it somewhere, and what you find out when looking from a side is something like that. There's a many, many layers of wires, and then there's a layer of transistors. So this is Intel's processor 40 nanometer technology, so already 7 years old. But still in use. And if you zoom in to the very bottom, you start to see single transistors. And transistor has always a drain and source, so current goes from here to here, and then you control it with a gate in the middle. That's a basic transistor. And the size here is a 42 nanometer. So this 14 nanometer technology does not actually mean that transistor is 14 nanometer. It means line width. Transistor is bit bigger. And if you, okay, so this is actually taken from a little bit older, but there you have a little bit different structure, and the previous one was quite boring looking. And if you start to see what is needed here, so you have these copper connectors. So basically, they are, yeah, usually they are made from copper. That's a good conductor, and don't be heated so much. Okay, gold would be better, but a little bit too expensive. So copper is a good compromise. And they are made by so-called physical vapor deposition, soon you hear what it is, and electroplating. So you have always, most of you are, at least in, who have been in a Finnish school, have sometime in a chemistry class made this, that you put a cold salt in the water and you put voltage across it, and then you put your key there, and then it's coated with a cold. Same method is used to produce this. So it's called electroplating. Then you have diffusion barriers. Copper has a nasty habit that it starts to diffuse around, and it could basically connect these two wires, and then it's goodbye the processor. So that's why you need a barrier. And there's many materials doing that, and many methods. We will go through them later. And something you should remember also, there's a lot of dielectric insulator to separate these wires. And you have to have a so-called low K material, which means that the dielectric constant is small. So if a K is not familiar, so this means basically small dielectric constant, if that's a more familiar term. Because you don't want capacitive coupling. If you have studied any electricity, you know that the higher dielectric constant, the better coupling between from here to the next wire. So you want to minimize that. Then you have seen this kind of layers. And all these layers, you fabricate one layer and then you polish it. And basically, you need a layer to stop that polishing, which is some hard dielectric like silicon nitride. And that's made by chemical vapor deposition, which we will also learn soon. And at the very end, at the below here, you have a tungsten plug which connects it to the transistors. And there you have a contact material. So all the metals have a work function, which has to match to your transistor. And transistor is a semiconductor. There was a little bit discussion in Kaisa's class earlier that semiconductor have a certain band gap. And that basically have to match to the work function of a metal. A little bit simplified way to say it. It's not exactly so trivial, but around that. And copper is not good. It has a wrong work function. And if you connect that to the semiconductor, you might get a diode instead of connect. So that's why you have some other material there, like a cobalt, nickel, titanium. These are used for that purpose. And then you, in your semiconductor layer, you have doping profiling. So you have your transistor, which has a doping. But what is most important here, you have a gate. So here you have a connection. So there's a drain. Maybe I should use some pointer so that everybody sees how to get the pointer. Not so familiar with this yet. Now I have a pointer. So you have some, I didn't work. What? Okay, now it works. So I have a drain and source, which is connecting our transistor somewhere in the lowest layer. And then I have a gate here in the middle, which is not connected. And there you have a insulator with a high dielectric constant. So you make a good connection, because you want your transistor to work fast and have a good control, so not losing energy. And this has been actually the biggest reason for producing heat in the processors. Because you make things smaller and smaller, your dielectric also gets thinner and thinner. And it used to be silicon oxide, always, because that's easy to fabricate, and you always have a silicon, you just put oxygen and it oxidizes it, so you have an oxide. But it started to get so thin, about two atoms or two molecules, so it started to leak huge amounts. And if you make it thicker, you don't have a good enough connection for that small structure. So the solution was that you take a high dielectric constant insulator so you can make it thicker and still produce the same good connection. And this is nowadays done always, and then, but it demands one extra step, which we will see a little bit later. But this kind of development happening. So nowadays, it's always something like hafnium oxide. Sounds very exotic, and it is. And the reason is that you have a high dielectric constant. Okay, so in this kind of processors, what you are using is a silicon. I already mentioned it several times now. And a silicon, basically, if you do devices like a transistors, it requires dopant. We will discuss what is exactly doping and what is affecting later, not today, but I think next lecture. Doping, which means that you put extra electrons or take away electrons. So you change out silicon atoms to something close by atoms. And you require this kind of dopant concentration, something like 10 to 15 or 10 to 20 atoms per cubic centimeter. And for the device to work, you have to have impurities about maximum 1% of this. So this means 10 to 13 atoms maximum in a cubic centimeter. And silicon, okay, like many, like all materials have around this atoms per cubic centimeter, 10 to 22. And if you calculate, what does it mean that you have 1% of this? So 10 to 13 divided by 10 to 22, this means that you have a, okay, this way is supposed to in English, is it milliard or is it a billion? Which one it is in English? 10 to minus 9. So every, sorry?
Depends on the country.
Exactly. We are in Finland, so it's 1 millionth part of atoms is an impurity. So which means it's really clean. You have to get it really clean. There cannot be much impurities. And this is how it's usually done. You have here silicon, which is melted, and you start dragging up, rotating and dragging up this kind of rod. Here, at the joint, you have this kind of single seed silicon from your previous silicon rod. How you get the first one, don't ask me. It has been there decades. Somebody always have this piece of single seed, single crystal silicon, and then you dip that into the silicon and start rotating and rising it up. Since it's a single crystal, the new atoms will go exactly the same single crystal if you do it correctly. And then you slowly rise it up and you get this kind of rod. So this can be 8 inches wide, something like that, and it can be meters long. So it's a really big piece of silicon. Then you just cut it and polish and you get the wafers, and then you do your magic and you get the devices. So this is actually the chemistry, what's happening there. So you start from a silica sand, so you dig it from a ground. Not all sand is good, but you have to have the silica sand, so it's kind of a silicon dioxide. And you put the carbon as a gas, and it reduces it to the silicon and make a carbon monoxide. So not very good for climate. And you know how much silicon is needed, so this is one way to, this is a kind of a producing a lot of these toxic gases. After that, you have so-called metallurgical grade silicon, which is 98% pure. So you can use it as a mechanical thing, not devices, because it's not pure enough. Then you melt it back, take a hard acid, hydrochloride, and you basically dissolve it to this form, which I'm a physicist, I'm not used to say it, so you can read it. And you produce this compound, and then your hydrogen goes out as a gas. Ah, it's written here, that's handy. Trichlorosilane, yeah. I was wiser as I remember when doing this. And then this gas is again taken to some pipe to another place and solidified again. You basically do the opposite of this, so you change the temperature or some other conditions so that it goes the other way around the process, and you get the silicon. So it's basically like a distillation. So you make it as a gas, and then you solidify in a different places, and all the impurities are taken out on the way. And then you start this dipping and rising, what I already mentioned. Okay, so you have a really clean silicon. Now you want to do something on that, and something what is in the size of a nanometers. And this air here, what we are breathing, it has a lot of particles. Most of them much bigger than a nanometers. So like micrometers, all the dust particles are bigger. So they are like a meteorite and they hit your sample. You don't want these to be around. That's why you do your operation in a clean room. So here's exactly what kind of things you have here. Okay, viruses, hopefully not so much here. And so this is kind of airborne particles. And bacteria. So viruses are actually the smallest ones. Then there's basically settling dust, the thing you find here. This is kind of 1 to 100 micrometers. That's already huge. And then there's much smaller particles which are going in air and not settling down because they are so small. Of course, you have here's a fly ash. If you burn something, this is already microns. And tobacco smoke is actually also from 1 nanometer to 1 micron, so it's also a bad size for your samples. And of course gases, but these are not usually harming anything except yourself, but not to the sample. So how is this kind of clean room working? So basically, the biggest contaminator is yourself. You are producing dust particles like a millions in a second. If you're wearing usual clothes like we are now, that's why you should dress up this kind of long fiber clothing which doesn't produce dust. And cover, you cover also face as much as possible. And sometimes you even have this kind of helmet, like a space helmet. But it depends what is your classification of your clean room, how clean it is. And basically what happens is that you have this kind of ceiling which produces laminar flow. So it's exactly laminar. So it goes like, you know what means laminar. So it goes like smoothly down and no turbulences. As soon as you have turbulences, they kind of take all the dust particles from the tables to air. But as long as it's laminar, it pushes all the dust to the floor, where it is taken out by some ventilation, driven to the huge HEPA filters, and then feed it back. Of course, you take a fresh air in the middle, otherwise you run out of oxygen. Most of our air is actually circulating, so it's 1/3 is taken as a fresh air. And that's why all the tables you see in a clean room, they are full of holes, just because that the air goes down, that they don't stop the air and make a turbulence. So they are not very handy for small pieces, so that's why you need something to keep your things not falling to the holes. And also the humidity and temperature are carefully controlled. For example, we have here ISO 5 level clean room, which has a 3,500 particles per square meter. Sounds big, but it's already 100 or 1,000 times less than the usual air, usual clean air. And you have this kind of table for these different classifications. So basically, the smaller the number, the better. ISO 1 means that you have only 10 of the smallest particles around. So this is really clean. I have once in my life been in that kind of clean room, and that clean room was inside the clean room. So you were in a usual clean room, and then you have to change the clothing and go to this airlock, and then you are even cleaner. So this is only for some special cases. So just to make some comparison, or for example, hospital surgery rooms, and these, they are also kind of clean rooms, and they are somewhere 4 and 5 level. But of course, there you are extra careful also for bacteria. So you disinfect. In this kind of nanofabrication clean room, bacteria are just like dust. It's just annoying there. But not infecting your sample. Okay, so that's basically the clean room. Let's see if we have a time, actually, end of lecture, we can even go to see the clean room if you haven't been there. Or you have been in an imaging course already. Yeah, so you have been there. Basic lithography steps. You have basically thin film deposition. So you can make layers on top of your sample, like a resist or metal coating. You have to pattern the resist, and then you can add something or you can remove something. So let's go this in a little bit more detail. So resist is some polymer which is sensitive to radiation or usually it's a radiation. It can be also electron beam. And or ion beam, or there's many things you can use. And how you make this kind of polymer as a very thin layer on your chip, it's actually a very simple method. Here is a full wafer. You can also take a small pieces as we do here. You put it in a so-called spinner, and as the name says, it just spins around with a huge speed, and then you put a drop on the middle and it spreads out. And then it basically depends on the viscosity of your drop, speed, how much you're spinning, what is the final thickness. And you can get as small as 50 nanometer. This sounds surprisingly by this kind of simple method, but you can really get to that. We have easily fabricated also 30 nanometer. But also you can make a thick films also. You just rotate it slower and put a more viscous resist. And then what happens? Then you shine light to the certain part of your resist. And what happens to the resist depends what kind of resist you have. You can have a positive resist, which means that in the places where you shine your light, it breaks up. So you have usually these long polymer chains. The most common is so-called PMMA, polymetal methyl acrylate, which is actually the same flexit glass what you have, for example, in ice hockey ring at the end of it's actually exactly the same material. But if you make it really soluble, so you put some solvent and make it liquid, you can use it as a resist. And that's actually the most common one. And this is exactly positive resist. When you shine light or some other energy, you break it down. And what then you, in a development, you can basically take away the parts which are broke down without taking other parts away. So that's the idea. You can have also negative resist, which means that you might have some smaller polymer chains, and then you shine the light, and what happens is actually that you get cross-link. So the smaller polymer chains are linked together, making longer chain. And then it's harder to remove, and the other parts are removed in this case. And of course, it just depends what you want. If you want some small structure somewhere, it's nice to use a positive resist, so you can just draw that structure. But if you want one structure to be not coated with something and everything else will be coated, then it's of course more handy to use a negative resist. And basic principle of photolithography. So if you let's go step by step. You have a substrate, silicon. Many times, at least here in the research, you don't want directly fabricate silicon because it's conducting. If you want to do something electrically, you have to put some insulator, which is usually silicon oxide, that you can easily do there. So you spin coat your photoresist. Then you take your light source, and you have a mask which has a holes. So radiation goes through only the holes. And these parts are exposed. You can have here some lenses. Let's draw a lens there. You can have a lens there, which means that your mask can be this big and your final structure is this. So it's focusing the light. This is possible. But usually the best resolution is that you have a mask same size and you make it in a contact. So there's no air between. But what happens then? These parts are exposed. And then you take it. Okay, so we assume here positive resist. So these parts are break up, polymer chain. Then you put it in a development, and what happens is that broken parts are going away, and you are left with your structure. And this is the final product you get out of here. So after that, depends what you want to do. Now you have your resist with a same shape as your mask. So you have transport your button to the mask. Usually you want to do something with that. You don't want just to be a resist. You can add things. Deposition. So you can make a thin layer of whatever material. And there's so many methods we will see soon. And then you have this kind of course, when you deposit, it goes everywhere. This is exactly why you need the lithography step before. Because in a deposition, usually you cannot control where your film is deposited. This is extremely hard. So that's why you need the resist. And now, basically here, on top of resist, you have the same film than here, which is directly connected to the substrate. So here is touching the substrate, and here is the top of the resist. And then you put the lift off, which means you lift off everything unknown needed. And usually it's in acetone. Okay, it can be something else, but if you have any polymer, acetone works. And then it takes away the rest of the resist, and of course, the deposited film on top of that is removed. And now you are left with your structure, with a, for example, metal, if you make some electrical wiring or something. Of course, you can. Welcome. You can do other way around. You can start taking away material. This is especially handy if you have already full film deposited. Then you can make pattern it by this way. So this is kind of called etching. So you remove material. And when you put some solvent or strong acids or whatever is your substrate, you start digging it out and you make a holes. And then of course it's no more called lift off because you are not lifting your deposited material off, but you are just stripping the resist. So there's just a different term, same process. But that's a kind of a slang of the industry. So this is the two ways you can do. And basically, by repeating this all over, you have your structure, then you want on top of that some interconnects. You spin a new resist, you start all over. Then you have your connectors, then you want to make a transistor, you spin a new resist and do it all over. So there's a thousands of these kind of steps, for example, some integrated circuits. It seems complicated, but these are done quite routinely. And if we talk about photolithography, what is the limiting case is the diffraction limit. This is actually the statue of Abbe. It looks like a Death Star. And it is kind of Death Star for a photolithography because this formula here tells that the resolution you can get, D, is your wavelength divided by 2 times refractive index and then a little bit depends on angle. So that's your limit. The resolution of photolithography is limited by that. The statue you can find in the front of, what is the name? University in Jena, Germany, early Eastern Germany. I have been there taking that photo. it's not looking like Abbe. So this is a limit. Basically, the solution to go around is reduced wavelength, of course. And people have reduced it. So there's a different wavelengths. used. I don't know how much this is actually in use, this really energetic UV, like a 13 nanometers. I don't think it's much actually used. But what is other thing is you can increase the N, refractive index. So this means that you do your lithography inside some surrounding medium. Immersion lithography it's called. So you take some thick oil and put your system there and do the magic lithography there. Then you get a better resolution. Then you can use interference phases of light sources, if they are lasers as they are, and so on. Many, many tricks to get this resolution. So this 22 is, for example, that's made with a 193 nanometer wavelength. So it's certainly somehow going around the diffraction limit. Everything now is made in a immersion lithography. And then you have a double patterning. So you expose your sample here, some wire, for example, this fit. And you want a more narrow wire. You don't expose it enough. And then you expose the same pattern here. And only the overlap area gets enough dose. These kind of tricks. Okay, here we don't want to use these tricks, since we can do something much more clever. And any research facility uses e-beam lithography, where you have electron beam which is focused, that you can focus in a 5 nanometer spot. And then what you do is you just scan with your electron beam, and that exposes your resist. Okay, why aren't these integrated circuits made by this? You can make them much smaller. Quick answer.
Takes too long.
Yeah, takes too long means people have to work more, longer. They have to be paid. That's money counts. So it's too slow. It's too expensive. So that's why it's not used. There it is. Okay, I have dropped out accidentally a couple of lines. There should be. Now I have to write. So it's too slow and expensive. For industry. But it's in use in every university and research center. Okay, can you do some calculation in your head? Or you have some computer open? Or you have to make this kind of pattern in an e-beam. And of course, you have to have certain dose to make this expose. As I mentioned already, you expose this, for example, and you expose next line, only the area between gets enough dose. So everything depends on a dose. How much you put radiation power or electron beam to a certain point. And that's counted as coulombs per cube centimeter. And now you want to make 1 square centimeter pattern, something. And you need to draw it by electron beam, which produces 1 nanoampere. This is very the usual usual amount of how much current you get from your electrons in a beam. And of course, you have a current, I is a current, and then you have a time. Current is on certain time, so current is coulomb per second. And then you multiply it by time, you get a coulomb, how many coulombs you get. And then you have to, what you have to get is a dose needed. It's in, okay, coulomb pointer. Okay, so it's underlined almost. This is the dose you need, and this is area. Actually, I haven't calculated it. So if you have a calculator, please calculate how long time you need. Sounds like a quite correct. So
10 to the power 6 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. So basically by that, and then you put the numbers there. So what you need is 10 to minus 3, this is just 1, and then you divide it 10 to minus 9, and what you get is 10 to 6 seconds, and that was how much in hours? How much hours does a week?
That's 11 and a half days.
Yeah. Not done in a week. So, and if you compare your processors in a computer or something, I think they are exactly the size of a 1 square centimeter. So it would take a week to make one layer. Then you need this 50 other layers. So no way. That's not the way to do it. There was an invention already in 94, which is called nano-imprint lithography. Ah, one thing I forgot to mention, you know, electron beam lithography. One very good thing is that you don't need that mask, what you need in a photolithography. You can just make a computer that drawing and tell the computer guiding the electron beam that do this. Of course, in a photolithography, you have to get the mask, and usually the mask is the same size as your structure, so you have to do it by electron beam lithography or something like that in the first time. But then you have it, and then you can just start making it repeatedly. But in a nano-imprint lithography, the idea is similar, that you need a mask, or actually in this case it's called mold. This is a 3D structure. And you make your resist, and then you just press your mold to the resist, and you make a resist really thin on these places where you press more. And if you think that you have some 30, 50 nanometer resist and you start pushing it, you need a huge power. So usually the resist is actually in a liquid form at this time. And then you just cure it by UV light or something when you have pressed. And basically by this, you can get, if you make this mold by electron beam lithography, and then you can start stamping your chips, basically. And you get a similar resolution than the electron beam, and faster. So in that sense, this is very, very handy method. It's now getting more and more popular. There's another method also, which is not so high resolution, but it's in a 3D. So you have so-called multi-photon lithography, which means that you have a laser, which is just where you are shooting to the resist, which is in a liquid form. And this laser light is, the power of or intensity of a laser light is tuned so that you have a high enough power only in a focus point. And then you can move basically by focusing, you can move the focus point up and down, and of course you can move the whole laser sideways, so you can just draw your structure. And the resist will be hardened or cured exactly the points where the focus traveled. There's a, for example, made this kind of cages to grow cells in some biological experiment. And what it means is two photon means that at this point the intensity is so high that usually you have a laser 800, or actually it's usually red laser, so 600 nanometers around, but your resist usually is UV light, short wavelength. So it means it needs 300 nanometer light. So here, when intensity is high enough, you can actually make three nanometer wavelength light out of a 600 by adding two photons. So it's exactly twice the energy. 300 nanometer light has twice the energy of a 600 nanometer light. So you add two photons, and these photons together expose. So you kind of produce 300 nanometer light. Basically, it never is 300 nanometer light, but the effect is the same. But you have to have a high enough intensity, because this is so-called non-linear process to make it happen. Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's why you need a high laser intensity, big laser, and it's also slow. Okay, so this is a summary of lithography. I think that we now understand how it works. So you make a fabrication nanostructures, we expose a resist layer one way or another, photolithography, e-beam lithography, 3D lithography, nano imprint. And after development, we have a pattern resist layer. And this is exactly, as it says, just the start of the process. It's actually time. There's no clock. Who is there? No.
Is there a break also somewhere?
Ten over ten. Okay. Yes, now I have a clock. Let's go a little bit more. Still before. Growing thin films. You have your pattern, you want to do something for it. And there's some material, so if you think you need conductors, you need semiconductors, you need insulators. Insulators work also for optics. And if you start from elements, what is used, so conductor, aluminum, copper, gold, titanium, and actually the most common. Titanium is not obvious, but aluminum, copper, and gold are. Yeah, then there's some more exotic, wolfgang, molybdenum, tantalum, silver. They sound exotic, but they are actually very much used. These wolfram and the molybdenum are used just because of work function, and also they are really hard materials. Aluminium just because it's easy, and copper and gold are good conductors. In a semiconductor, yes, there's a silicon and there's a germanium also used as elements. Do you know why silicon is not used mostly, not germanium? No. You can get it as cheap if you would have developed the same. And it would be actually better. It has a little bit higher band gap, so you don't need so pure germanium as you need silicon. But because of that, you need more energy to operate. And in a silicon, you don't need so much energy. And also in the germanium, you cannot produce germanium oxide as an insulator layer. In a silicon, you just let oxygen in and you have an insulator layer. So these are the two reasons why silicon won the competition over germanium, even the first transistors was germanium. So it's more like a practical reason. Germany would be a little bit better. An insulator, if you think insulator were made from one element, basically the only thing is a diamond. Then oxides, you have a conductor, conducting oxides, indium, tritium oxide, so-called ITO, indium titanium oxide. So this is actually only used because it's a transparent. If you need some transparent electrode, like, you know, solar cells, then you use this. Ruthenium oxide is just used for measuring things like temperature and so on, because it's very stable, not like a metal. Semiconductor, okay, there's not much oxide. But insulators, there's a bunch of oxides. What I already mentioned, silicon oxide, aluminum oxide, so which is sapphire, basically, that's easy to fabricate. Also, because aluminum oxide immediately oxidizes, like silicon also. And then there's this, for example, this hafnium oxide, which is this high dielectric constant. And then there's a nitride from almost any metal, you can make a nitride. And these ones, titanium, tantalum, and wolfram, so these are actually conducting nitrides. It's surprising that they are conducting. Semiconductor, gallium nitride. Then you have a silicon nitride, aluminum nitride, a boron nitride. So these are very hard materials used for covering things. Then few others, more exotic. Especially in a semiconductor, you have this kind of silicon carbide or gallium arsenide is nowadays used a lot. And indium phosphide. So these are maybe not the materials which comes to your mind in the first, if you haven't done nanofabrication. Was there some question?
No, we were just wondering that this becomes a distance 12 hour. So.
Ah, yeah, it is actually 12, yeah.
Sounds difficult.
It is, but it works. So it's basically aluminium, which you have just made a little bit harder by wolfram. Okay, how do you make your film? One way to make it is a physical vapor deposition, which means that you physically make your film. So you take a big hammer, you have some material here, you start hammering pieces of it, and these pieces are thrown somewhere and detach into your sample. So that's basically the idea of physical vapor deposition. And usually, yeah, of course you would make it more subtle. So you have a hammering is very small, taking atoms out, not big pieces usually, and you transport them through vacuum to the substrate. And you need to have a vacuum because otherwise they will react on a way, and then you don't have a pure result, but you have a full of impurities. Usually metal or metal compounds always fabricated by PVD method. You can think of blacksmith making these kind of metallic things by hammering. So metal is easily fabricated or saved by physical methods. There's many ways. Evaporation, resistive evaporation or electron beam evaporation. And then there's a so-called special case. Actually, I will show a little bit more of all these. So let's not discuss here so more. So the easiest, simplest way is evaporation. So you take a big vacuum chamber, you take your metal there, you heat it so that it evaporates, and then you have a sample at the room temperature, so it's cold, and as a metallic gas hits the sample, it will be solidified and you grow film. very easy. One nice thing is this is also, it's a, so basically, I should have a pointer. Always forget to change it. So you have a really good vacuum, which means that the mean free path of atoms and molecules is larger than the diameter of a vacuum chamber. Mean free path is the length the molecule or atom travels before hitting another atom. So this means that when you start as an atom here, metal atom traveling this direction, you don't meet any other atoms, but you go directly to your substrate. This means that you have a line of sight coverage. So basically, if you look from here, what you see is covered. So nothing here is covered, because all the atoms which would travel there are hitting this sample. But here, these walls are covered, for example, and so on. This can be useful. So you can easily make shadows. You put some mask on front of your target, and that part will be not deposited. But sometimes it's actually a bad thing. Sometimes you want to deposit something which is not flat, and you want to deposit every side of that, and then this doesn't work. And basically, the flux of atoms from a heated target is related to the pressure. This is a vapor pressure of that material. Maybe I look actually right. Vapor pressure. And all the materials has a vapor pressure which depends on the temperature. When you start heating at some point, it's higher than the surrounding pressure, then it starts to evaporate. And of course, since it's a different for different metals, for example, and if you want to evaporate some alloy, so you have some two metals in your crucible and you start evaporate that, you might only end up evaporating the one which has a higher vapor pressure. Because that goes off first. And second, maybe never goes off. At least you don't sustain your ratio of metals. So that's why it is not good for any compounds or alloys. You have to use some other method for that. But this is a simple. And also you can thickness you can control just by shutter. You put something on the top of your molecule beam, and then you open it. You count how many seconds you keep it open. You have a usually some kind of a meter to telling how much you get deposition per second, and then you just close it. This is your thickness control. It can be made very precise, even it sounds not so precise. But you can control in a 0.1 nanometer accuracy. Another more very common is a sputtering. And it's exactly, basically as simple, but it has exactly opposite properties. What you usually do, you put a gas, sputtering gas, which is usually argon, because they are big and not reactive. And what you make is a plasma. So, and what is a plasma? Plasma is a positive ions and electrons. So what happens there is you take a huge electric field so that it actually rips off electrons from atoms. It can be oscillating field or it can be DC field. And as soon as it rips off electrons, that electron hits the next atom and kicks off more electrons and so on. So it's kind of chain reaction. So you start increasing your voltage. At some point, the plasma just starts glowing. And it's a very sudden, because it's a chain reaction. And what happens then, as I said, that you have a voltage, so you have a negative voltage in your target, in your target, which is a material you are hammering, and the positive ions are of course accelerated to that. So here, as you see, so they are accelerated to this negative target, and as soon as they hit the target, they will kick off atom of that target. And then that atom travels inside the chamber and ends up to your sample. And how it ends up to the sample is not like an evaporation from here directly here. But since there's this plasma, lots of ions, lots of electrons, it will collide, all of them on the way. Of course, not all, but many. So it can arrive, for example, this kind of path, and then finally going here. So it can come from any direction. So you get coverage also for vertical walls, and like which you don't cover in evaporation. So in that sense, this is different. Also, due to the plasma physics, which I don't have time to explain fully, there's also ions bombarding the target. The sample. So target is a material you are sputtering, and your sample, which is getting the material, there's also ions bombarding that a little bit. Not so much voltage, but because actually the plasma is positive, because electrons have so much speed that they just disappear very quickly. You have mostly positive ions and little bit electrons. So that's why this potential is actually even higher than your sample potential. So that's why you have a little bit voltage there accelerating, which means that you actually hammering your field. You are detaching, you are getting some detached atoms from your target to your substrate, and then you are just taking more ions to hammer it there to make it really dense film. So that's one good thing in sputtering. And then there's a very special case of evaporation, which is molecular beam epitaxy. Sounds fancy. It is fancy, but it's just evaporation. So what you now do, you instead of just heating your metal, you heat it in a closed container. It forms an equilibrium between the vapor and a solid phase. And then you have a tiny, tiny hole which kind of spits out molecule by molecule. It's so small but just by the kind of probability makes it so that you get only one molecule at a time. So that's why molecular beam. So you have a molecule beaming here to your sample. Okay, sounds slow. It is slow, but they are coming so slow, and your sample is heated that you can actually grow single crystal. If you heat enough your sample, so you produce energy that as soon as your molecule is hitting your sample, it has some energy to diffuse around, which then starts making single crystal. So this is one way to make this kind of gallium arsenide semiconductors, for example, which is compound of gallium and arsenide. So you take here gallium beam and arsenide beam, and then you both are coming. You can make it layer by layer, but usually they are mixed together. And then you can put some aluminium and some other dopants in certain places. This is a very precise method, but it's again slow and expensive. That's why these gallium arsenide semiconductors are only for special components. Okay, of course, opposite to physical vapor deposition, you have a chemical vapor deposition. What is the difference here is that you make so-called precursors, which are gas or vapor, and they react or decompose on the substrate. So you have some chemical reaction happening on the substrate. And this is kind of a method for any dielectric, because they are usually like a silicon dioxide, silicon nitride, so they are compounds. And this is always better method than evaporation. You can evaporate, for example, silicon nitride, silicon dioxide, but you don't get very good results. But you should use chemical vapor deposition. And this is used extensively in the semiconductor industry. So you have your gas coming, you have a gas flow here, and some of these molecules go to the substrate and react, and then you grow the film, your film after the reaction, and maybe some byproducts which are then taken up and taken away by this gas flow. What is missing from a picture? Why do you do the reaction here and not just randomly here, the gas phase? Yeah, this is a good example. Yes, you have a copper as a catalyst for reaction. Yeah, this is one way, but that's not the most common way. I was after something else, because easily, for example, silicon nitride, you need xylene or an oxygen, xylene and oxygen, which could react here and just produce a silicon dioxide dust, which then lands on the sample. And this happens if you do it wrong. But what is needed is some energy at the surface, or catalyst to go around the energy barrier. But usually it's energy needed here. So it means that you heat your sample. Your gas is cold, no reactions happening. But as soon as it hits the sample, it has enough energy due to heating. And this is the way. You heat your substrate, and then it happens only there. And as I said, if you have not enough heating in a substrate and too high temperature gas, then you are producing such dust and no film. Sometimes you don't want to heat. You have made your fine cold structure, some 50 nanometer lines, they are nicely going. And then you want to cover it with, for example, silicon oxide as an insulator or silicon nitride to more mechanical cover. And if you want to do the CVD, you have to heat 2000 degrees. If you heat cold 2000 degrees, it's start to diffuse all over. There's no lines anymore after that. Then you use plasma enhanced CVD. You make a plasma to give the energy to the substrate. And one thing is that you crack your gas molecules, what you all these precursor molecules of what you put in. You basically, you make them excited, for example, then they become a radical, which reacts much more easily at the lower temperatures. Or you ionize them also. So you have a combination of excited radical species and ions. And these ions actually do similar ion bombardment as in a sputtering. So you are hammering also your film, you make it more dense. That's why you have a really good adhesion. And that's why you don't have a holes. When you regular CVD and you have some dust particles somewhere or some other contaminant, then you easily start growing your film all around it, and then you have a hole through it after. Here, basically, the ion bombardment just kills it. And you get good step coverage, like in a sputtering, so you can cover vertical walls. And as I mentioned, compatible with your fine line patterns. So that's why. So it's basically a combination of a sputtering and a CVD, chemical vapor deposition. So this is also what we use here, for example. It's not good for mass production because it's kind of a, you can only fit certain amount of wafers. But if you have regular CVD, you can have this kind of tube with a packed with a wafers, and then you can process them all at the same time. So here's a couple of examples of reactions. For example, silicon oxide and silicon nitride, which are the most common. Both you use silane, SiH4. Not nice gas. If it is air, it explodes. So you have to keep it in a chamber, not leaking out. And then you take oxygen, or you take a nitrate or oxygen, which is a laughing gas. And you react that with a silane, and you get the silicon oxide and the byproducts. Why oxygen is, usually this oxygen is used in regular CVD, and the laughing gas is used in plasma enhanced, because oxygen and plasma, it's a little bit too reactive. Oxygen in the plasma mode. And usually you need something 400, 500 degree in a regular CV. But if you use plasma, you can go as low as 200, and then you cold plunge stay. And in a nitride, it's even more dramatic. So there you just take a same silane and nitrogen, or this other compound, which some chemists can say what it is. Sorry? Yeah, I think so, but I wasn't certain. I didn't want to say it wrong. And then you usually have 1,000 degree in a regular CVD and only 400 needed with a plasma. So that kind of reduces a lot. I think this is a good time for break. So it's 10:30, so or 10 to 11, 15 minutes, yeah.